day and allow me to say goodbye.
This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features speaker David Barsamian, and he's going to talk about media, capitalism, and the environment. This program was recorded on Sunday, October the 12th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri, and we're happy to present Mr. Barsamian. He's the founder of Alternative Radio, which is broadcast right here on KKFI, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. So with no further delay, we will present the first of two introductions to today's All Souls Forum.
Good morning. I'm Rita Norton, a member of the forum committee that organizes these platforms for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in the contemporary world. FYI, we are being recorded for in-church use and probable broadcast on KKFI. The regulars in the audience know that Kansas City area has hundreds of worthy speakers. Every once in a while, however, like today, the forum finds exceptional speakers from outside the area. David Barsamian, journalist and founder of Alternative Radio, is so special that I've garnered a specialist for his introduction, Tom Clammer of KKFI fame.
Thank you, Rita, and I'd like once again to thank the All Souls Forum for continuing Kansas City's longest ongoing conversation, making many wonderful speakers available to us, and I hope you will all tell your friends about the forum and support it any way you can. The fora are broadcast about a week or two later on 90.1 FM KKFI on Wednesdays. Please spread the word about that, too. Excuse me. And my old pal Mike Murphy has reminded me that today is the last day of our pledge drive. Think about participating in that, too. So David just made me promise to hold the intro to 45 minutes, so I have to leave a lot of stuff out. He's the founder and host of Alternative Radio, now in its 28th year. The show's heard on KKFI every Wednesday morning at 9, long attention span radio, and in my opinion, one of the very best shows on the air anyway. Adding to numerous awards he has received, it was just announced that David will receive the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. And his... Hear, hear. And his latest of many books is Power Systems, Conversations on Global Democratic Uprisings and the New Challenges to U.S. Empire. And this is a collection of interviews with Noam Chomsky. Do check out that title and other books and audio CDs in the lobby after this presentation. David lectures on world affairs, imperialism, the state of journalism, censorship, the economic crisis, and global rebellions. I give you David Barsamian.
Well, good morning, Kansas City. Hey, it's great to see you all here, and it's wonderful to be back in Kansas City after quite a number of years. So thanks to all of you. Thanks to Tom for that introduction, Tom Crane hosting me, Rita Norton who got me here. And it's always about people in community getting together and doing things and overcoming apathy, overcoming passivity. Because when you're engaged in something, it gives you energy. You know, we can all be in front of the computer or the TV and think, well, you know, are the Royals going to make it to the series? What about the Chiefs? Did they make the right decision in trading for Alex Smith and things like that? And it's, We're diverted. I call the corporate media a weapon of mass distraction. That it's a real WMD, and we should think about the problem of the media in this country as a public health issue. You know, and I wish that the Surgeon General, the way he or she labels cigarette packets, as you know, is carcinogenic, is fatal to women or whatever. In the same way, we should have scrolls underneath the corporate media when they come on and saying, if you watch this, you'll get depressed, you'll have migraines, you'll get stomach aches. That will really define the corporate media as a national health problem. And indeed it is. For a society to be vigorous, to be engaged, to be active, we need independent media. That's why you are blessed, I don't use that word loosely, in Kansas City to have KKFI. I travel all over the country, and you must think, well, probably Boston must have the best community radio station in the country, right? Up and down the East Coast, liberal city, the Athens on the Charles, as they call it. Noam Chomsky lives there. Howard Zinn lived there for many years. Holly Sklar, Chip Berlay, all these great liberal activists, they don't have a station like KKFI. They have two big NPR affiliates that drone on and on with Some Things Considered, the afternoon news show, and Morning Edition, that's MOURNING. Or you can waste time watching the Petroleum Broadcasting Service, PBS, which has the snooze hour every evening. And then it has the, you know, intrepid Charlie Rose, who seems to never tire of asking fawning questions of Henry Kissinger or of Thomas Friedman. So to get back to KKFI and why you should support it and make it stronger, it is really a voice of audio independence in this entire community. And so there's an electronic umbilical cord connecting me in Boulder, Colorado, where I produce this weekly program, which you could hear Wednesday mornings at 9, and KKFI. We need each other. And that's how we can make a difference in the media landscape. So traveling around the country to other communities, you might think, well, you know, Miami, Chapel Hill, Philadelphia, Baltimore, they don't have community radio, and you have it here in Kansas City. So prize it, cherish it, nourish it, make it grow. And that will be, I think, a great thing for you to accomplish. And I'm often reminded, I suspect that KKFI and its founding had to overcome enormous obstacles, and it probably still has lots of problems in terms of funding and programming and that kind of thing. But it was Margaret Mead who years ago said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And when I started alternative radio in Boulder out of my house, I remember at the time my brother, we're from New York, if you couldn't tell from my accent, he asked me, well, how are you going to make money? How are you going to support this, you know, what you're doing? I said, well, I think, do people remember cassettes? There are a few people old enough to remember cassettes. I think, you know, I hope people will buy the cassettes, and that's how I'll fund the program. And then he said in his inimitable New York style, why would anyone want to buy cassettes when they heard something on the radio for free? What are they, stupid? And, you know, this isn't going to work. But, you know, I didn't listen to him, my big brother, and started AR, and, you know, it will soon be 30 years old, and just two Fridays ago, September 26th, I did a 30th anniversary interview with Noam Chomsky at MIT, celebrating 30 years of our collaboration in books and interviews. Howard Zinn was a great inspiration of mine, and he always talked about history and knowing history and the importance of understanding context and background. And that's where the corporate media, of course, completely falls on its face. Things just happen. ISIS comes out of the blue. Where did they come from? Then we had the Khorasan group. They suddenly appear, you know, one after another. Then there's Boko Haram. Then there's Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Then there's Al-Qaeda in North Africa. Then there's Libya. All of these things seem to happen in a vacuum with no historical background. So the societal ideological function of the corporate media is to deny you any understanding of the background of these events. Any historical context is vacuumed out in their reporting. So terrible things happen. We're horrified by beheadings. We're horrified by suicide car bombings. But we're not horrified perhaps by other things. Anyway, Howard Zinn also told me to use humor. So I composed this little ditty. Here it goes. Hey, hey, NSA, how many people are you going to spy on today and in what way? Hey, hey, TSA, who are you going to pull over at the airport today? Lies, 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 fill up agency files. UAVs rain death from the skies. Pilotless drones will blow out your eyes. Government agents, look out. Here comes the FBI. IEDs, RPGs, WMDs, CIA, DEA, NSC, DHS. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. There goes the USA. Now, I say that because actually Leonard Cohen had a song, Democracy is Coming to the USA. Some of you may remember. He's still around. He just turned 80. And he's a wonderful Canadian poet and songwriter. In the 70s, he wrote a song called Democracy is Coming to the USA. I think if he were rewriting it today, he'd put a question mark at the end of that, because it looks like democracy is under attack as we become, you know, in this wave of fear, the manufacturing of fear by the propaganda system, democracy is being eviscerated. We're being surveilled, our emails are being read, our text messages are being stored in a $1.5 billion facility, as it's called, in Bluffdale, Utah. All of our messages and emails are being collected by the government. But you know what they tell you? Well, if you haven't done anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about. This is the opening to a police state. When you have that kind of surveillance and control, and when they tell you things like, well, you know, you mind if I search the back of your car or your glove compartment? Hey, if you have nothing, if you haven't hidden anything, you have nothing to worry about. That kind of, these kinds of tramplings of our basic fundamental freedoms is something that should energize people that call themselves conservatives. They should really be, I don't consider this a liberal issue. I think this is an issue of right and wrong in terms of more and more intrusion into our privacy, the abrogation of our rights. And what has happened over the years of U.S. foreign interventions. You know, we have 737 military bases around the world. I hope, you know, we're all proud of that. As schools are closing in Colorado, as teachers are laid off, where, you know, where I live, where class size is getting bigger and bigger because, hey, there's no money. There's no money, but there's plenty of money for the Pentagon, for the war machine. Right now, we have now coming off the, from Bath, Maine, a new $3.2 billion destroyer, the Zumwalt class of destroyers. Presumably, this is going to protect us from invasions from the Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone and other countries that have huge navies. They don't. And I kid you not, the name of the captain of this ship is Kirk, Captain Kirk. And there are two more on the drawing board. So not only are we going to have one of these Zumwalt-class stealth destroyers, we're going to have two more. But, hey, that's a bargain compared to the Ford-class aircraft carriers that are now being proposed and are being built. They're coming in for a cool $13 billion a pop. So just think about that. You know, the next time you hear about a health clinic being closed, people being laid off, homes being foreclosed, lack of affordable housing. Where is the money going? It's going into the Pentagon, a war machine. All of course, to protect us from them, the artificial enemies that are out there. So I'm talking about the media. There are five corporations that control basically what most people see, hear, and read in the United States. So we have a citizenry that is largely uninformed. I mean, we live in the USA, the United States of Amnesia, as Gore Vidal called it. And that's because there, as I said, no historical background. Things just happen. It seems that people hate America. Why do they hate America? There is no understanding of policy, of U.S. Foreign affairs, of U.S. intervention in the internal affairs of other countries. In Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen. Those are all countries that we are bombing at this very moment in the name of democracy, in the name of freedom, in the name of protecting us, in the name of self-defense. And this is creating a huge amount of backlash around the world, not only in those countries, but in other countries as well. So five corporations control basically the media here. CNN, you know, Anderson Cooper, 360, maybe you like Anderson Cooper. He seems to be a very nice guy. He had on recently, they were doing a program on Iraq and ISIS, and he had Jay Carney on, who was a former White House press secretary, now CNN commentator, Jim Sciotto, a CNN national security correspondent, and Eli Lake of the Daily Beast. All of these, incidentally, white men. I guess he couldn't find anybody else, and there are not enough white males represented in the media, right? Wrong. And so what were the questions? The banner that's being scrolled. Should the U.S. keep troops in Iraq? Were ISIS warnings missed? What should Obama have done in this particular issue? Then a couple of days after that, and so it was a very narrow kind of discussion. You know, how did they miss this? You know, why do we have 17 intelligence agencies spending tens of billions of dollars and they didn't know about this organization and, you know, where did it come from? But an even worse example of the corporate media was Steve Kroft on 60 Minutes on September 28th, interviewing Obama. Rather, it wasn't an interview. It was a kind of opportunity for Obama to expound his ideas. So he said, America leads. We are the indispensable nation. Our military is the best in the history of the world. And when trouble comes up, they call us. That's the deal. And Kroft didn't ask any serious questions in terms of challenging Obama's premise or assumption that the United States is the indispensable nation in the world. This is the language of Madeleine Albright in the 1990s when she was Secretary of State, when she called the United States the indispensable nation. And someone said, well, what do you mean by that? And she said, we can see farther into the future. So now we have, you know, diplomats, heads of state, as well as secretaries of state, saying that they have psychic powers of being able to see in the future in order to justify what they are doing in the present. So we can't count on the corporate media to do any kind of serious reporting. And again, that's why we need to turn to other sources like Democracy Now!, like Making Contact, like Counterspin, like Alternative Radio. KKFI provides you with all of those outlets of independent thoughts and hearing. Now, about the environment and, of course, the capitalist economic system, sure, we have Earth Day, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Environmental Protection Agency. all of those things passed by the last liberal president of the United States. Anyone old enough to remember who that was? Richard Nixon. It'd be unthinkable today that any of those things would be legislated because the country, the political class, has shifted far, far to the right. I mean, I was appalled just watching TV the other night during the 10 o'clock news in Boulder, where I live, the hate ads, the vituperation that is just laced in these political attack ads against the senator there, Udall, and the governor of Colorado, Hickenlooper. But then I came here and found the same thing with attack ads on Davis and, is it Orman? Orman, yeah. Really poisonous, very toxic. And that's what a lot of the discourse has become. And, you know, thanks to the Supreme Court, we've had incredibly retrograde decisions on the amount of monies that can be spent in the political. So it's a level playing field. You can compete with the Koch brothers, right? So that sounds even to me. They've got tens of billions of dollars, and you've got your savings account and your Social Security retirement and whatever. That's called a level playing field. The whole system is awash in corporate cash. That's why it's corrupt, because the money is corrupting. And I know there's going to be an event here on the 29th. Clements is going to be speaking about Citizens United and the more recent decision on April 2nd of McCutcheon versus FEC, which has really taken the, you know, hinges off the door. They can do whatever they want in terms of spending. And that's why the political system is gridlocked. That's why it is deadlocked. That's why it is not performing. It is not providing us with the kinds of legislation and security that we need as citizens of this country. But still, the threat to our environment is acute and growing. The majority of solutions on offer, from driving a hybrid, in the West we call them Priuses, you know, the Prius, because people feel very virtuous that they're driving a Prius and somehow superior to other people. We recycle plastic. We use, you know, correct, efficient light bulbs. We recycle cardboard and glass and compost our vegetables and fruits. And, you know, I do all of those things. You know, it does give you a little bit of satisfaction. I don't drive a Prius. I have a Honda Civic. But it's not enough, because the nature of the crisis is so enormous. We are seducing ourselves, we're lulling ourselves into a false sense of security that we're going to be able to reverse global warming by recycling cardboard and our Sunday newspapers. It's not going to do it. We need radical change, and we need it now, not 5 years from now, 10 years from now. The more we delay, the more difficult it will be to change what is happening to the Earth's climate. But again, the corporate media come in and say, you know, well, the jury's still out. This scientist says that. This study came out. It becomes a he said, she said. Well, it's not. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the evidence is so overwhelming about what is happening to the environment, what is happening, the eco-crisis, the fossil fuels that are being injected into the atmosphere, heating up the Earth's atmosphere, causing water levels, sea levels to rise all over the world. It's not a question that is out there. The matter is settled. And the media pundits and the Koch brothers, who are incidentally, you know, huge investments in fossil fuel industry, the monies they inject create a certain amount of doubt where there is no doubt. And so this is preventing the political class, or it gives the political class in Washington the opportunity to say, well, we'll wait on that. And here, even, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize winning constitutional lawyer President Barack Obama, you know, is touting the effects of fracking and of, you know, possible use of tar sands oil. And they're talking about Saudi America. Is this a desirable outcome? Is this what we want, to keep pumping fossil fuels into the atmosphere atmosphere to make certain that our children and grandchildren will have a much diminished environment and ecosphere to live in? Is that what we want? Is that a desirable outcome? Well, it's certainly desirable if your name is ExxonMobil. It's certainly desirable if your name is BP or Shell or any of the other large petrochemical giants. They're making money hand over fist. In fact, in the history of capitalism, ExxonMobil recently set the record of close to $50 billion. I know that's a little bit less than what people make in this audience and your Social Security check, but still, $50 billion is not chump change. That certainly can buy you a few cappuccini at the Broadway Cafe or wherever you might be going to have your coffee. That's a lot of money. $50 billion take home the greatest net profit in the history of capitalist system. And this system, I think, we need to understand it, that what's driving it and what makes climate change action so difficult is the system is driven on the basis of constant expansion, on increasing profits, on more and more dividends for shareholders, shareholders who demand of their overpaid CEOs to generate more and more profits. And I think to understand a little bit of this, we should go to fiction, because fiction, as Arundhati Roy says, is often the greatest way of understanding facts. And F. Scott Fitzgerald, in The Great Gatsby, which is one of the most important books written about American capitalism, a novel, he wrote about the Roaring Twenties and Gatsby. They were careless people. They smashed up things and creatures. Then they retreated back into their money or their great carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together. They retreated and let other people clean up the messes they had made. And that's, I think, captures the essence of the capitalist economic system. What happens down the road is somebody else's problem. I'm here now as CEO of a corporation. I have to generate more and more profits. If it damages the atmosphere, if it compromises our environment, if it accelerates the eco-crisis, hey, that's somebody else's problem. That's down the road. I'm out of here. You know, I'll be dead and buried by the time that comes to fruition. So the system itself, and even such a radical as Pope Francis has recently said, today, everything comes under the laws of competition and the survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless. As a consequence, masses of people find themselves excluded and marginalized, without work, without any means of change. The idea that a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice in the world has never been confirmed by the facts. Never, Pope Francis said. Well, it's good to have the head of the Catholic Church on our side. And you have a wonderful economist here, Bill Black at UMKC, and he brought to my attention a quote from a French economist who said, this is a couple of centuries ago, when plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men living together in society, they create for themselves in the course of time a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it. And I think that really captures the essence of capitalism. We have a steady stream of reports on the deterioration of the environment. And again, there's what, as Chomsky says, what's really also left out are the people who believe these reports are understating the magnitude of the crisis. You don't hear about those voices. They're at MIT, they're at, you know, at other institutions. So all we hear about are kind of the mainstream reports that come out and then the climate deniers. But there is a third group that is being completely kind of cut off from any kind of media access. So there's a steady stream of reports. There's a brief flurry of media coverage. You know, maybe it'll get above the fold on the front page of the Kansas City Star or the New York Times or the Washington Post, and then it disappears. So when you're arguing something counter-hegemonic, when you're arguing something that is not yet mainstream and understood, if you don't have constant iteration of those ideas, then they don't sustain. They don't adhere. They get lost, and then we have to re-argue from the beginning every single time. So we need constant iteration of what is going on with the climate. What level of catastrophe is it going to take for business as usual policies to change? And we have these charades called climate summits, right? There's been one in Rio, Copenhagen, Durban, on and on. There was just one in Warsaw. The next one is in Paris. These are farces. These are like public publicity events where the great leaders of the world, that is to say the countries most responsible for the acceleration of climate change, they all get together, you know, they ship their Chardonnay or Merlot or whatever it is, and they take a group photograph, and the photograph is, you know, appears all over the media, and then they issue press releases saying how green they are, and then they go home and the same policies continue. There's no substantive change because of the corruption of politics where money is driving decision-making, not rational scientific evidence. So we blithely turn our heads away from reality as the ice caps melt. And it's not just the penguins and polar bears. Bless them. We all love them. They're cute. It's about us. Also, it's about the very survival of the species. Your children, your grandchildren, future generations are at risk. And it's well time overdue that we look at these issues and do something about it. Now, I have this new book with Chomsky. It's called Power Systems. And there's a lot of stuff in here about the environment. I'm just going to ask you, ask Chomsky. He's got grandchildren, so I ask him, what kind of world do you see them inheriting? A realistic projection would not be very attractive. But a lot depends on human will, as always. You cannot predict the course of social movements, of the efforts to change things. We can never do that. Nobody could have predicted in 1960 that a handful of black students sitting at a lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, would help set off a massive civil rights movement. And I should just interject there. Or Rosa Parks refusing to sit down on a bus in December 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, launching the Montgomery bus boycott. Nobody could have predicted in the early stages of the women's movement that it would radically change the culture. And it has in a very affected way. If you would have asked me a couple of years ago, you know, let's occupy Zuccotti Park and Wall Street, I'd have said, I think you're crazy. That's going to be a total waste of time. Well, it wasn't a waste of time. The Occupy movement did achieve a lot of things, and that's how change happens. It happens poco a poco. It happens si scala la scala, and you climb the stairs one step at a time. It's when you get together and say that you care. Another wonderful writer is Barbara Kingsolver. She's got a novel out called Flight Behavior about the environment. Also, there's an excellent film with Matt Damon called Promised Land, if you want to understand what fracking is doing to the environment. Kingsolver said, it's never irresponsible to speak of hope. It is irresponsible to give up. So I say to you on this Sunday morning, don't give up. Fight the fight. Think of future generations. Think about Pachamama. Think about Gaia. Think about Mother Nature. Think about Matra Bhumi, this sacred land that we inhabit, this pale blue dot in the universe, as Carl Sagan called our precious planet Earth. Thank you very much.
You're listening to David Barsamian, talking about media capitalism and the environment. Today's All Souls Forum. We owe you a message or two. Let's do that. We'll take a short break, and we'll come back with the question and answer session with the audience. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI, and we'll be right back.
90.1 FM is proudly supported by the Thanksgiving Blues Breakfast Team. Returning to the Kansas National Guard Armory Thursday, November 27th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Starring R&B artist Lattimore, along with Lady Vivian and Rockin' Rick. The Thanksgiving Blues Breakfast Dance is back. Thursday, November 27th. For information, ticket outlets and delivery, call 816-353-4373 or go to TicketKC.com. So unchain my heart,
baby, set me free. Hi, this is Groovy Grant, wishing you to join me today on OG's Hangout, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City. My guest today will be Mr. Alan Bell, formerly the manager for Big Joe Turner and also the late Thomas Tootie Gadsden. That's at 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. today on OG's Hangout, KKFI 90.1 FM.
On August 16, thousands of Palestinian solidarity activists convened at the Port of Oakland and blocked workers from the Longshore Union, ILWU, from unloading an Israeli cargo ship. The movement to block the boat for Gaza is growing. Find out about it this week on the Heartland Labor Forum. Also, last month, two speakers from Columbia were in Kansas City to explain where our cut flowers come from and the sweatshops that produce them. Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Most people, or many people in America, realize that there have been very significant changes in news production and dissemination, particularly the great diminishing of print newspapers and an upswelling of blogging and other sources of information on the internet. How are we to decide the legitimacy of those news sources and what they have to bring to us, and how are we to vet them and, you know, make decisions about that information that they are bringing to us?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's something that I face as a journalist all the time. How do I know what Chris Hedges is saying is true? How do I know what Glenn Greenwald is saying is true? Maybe he's making it up, or maybe he took a fact and then twisted it and embellished it and elaborated on it. Well, we cross-check is one way of vetting information. And, you know, people ask me about journalism and the future of journalism and, you know, where's the next Seymour Hersh? Well, I think they're out there. I'm actually very excited about what's happening in terms of independent journalism right now in the country. I don't remember a coterie, a cadre of more radical and talented journalists as we have right now with Glenn Greenwald, with Jeremy Scahill, with Laura Poitras, with Murtaza Hussein. There are a whole bunch, Chris Hedges, as I mentioned, a whole bunch of people out there doing absolutely terrific work, getting dirt under their fingernails, doing investigative reporting. And some of that is being funded from a very unlikely source, the founder of eBay, Pierre Omidyar, who was born in France. He's an Iranian American. He has given $250 million to start a new media outlet called The Intercept. And you could read their dispatches on the internet for free of charge. It's a very good source of information. Truth Dig, Truth Out, Common Dreams. There's all kinds of excellent information out there, but I'm interested. I think a lot of us have got information. What's the next step? What's the catalyst that we can take that information and put it into some kind of concrete action? So I think what you do here at the local level is absolutely critical. You know, think national, think statewide, think regionally, think nationally, think internationally, but act locally. It's what you do right here in the Kansas City area where you can make the greatest impact.
My concern is, as the Arctic melts, it seems to be the new frontier. Different corporations are rushing up there to get fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and also minerals. And I've read about these investment agreements in the different free trade agreements, like in the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. And it seems like they're trying to straitjacket democracy. And I'm wondering, do we truly have the freedoms that we think we do, or have they effectively signed these agreements that limit our ability to do much about the challenges?
Well, the whole issue of these so-called free trade. Now, when you hear the word free, you naturally have a warm and fuzzy feeling, right? We're all for free press, free food, free, you know, free market. But in fact, the free trade agreements, as they are, we have evidence as in terms of what NAFTA has produced. It's produced a devastation in the Mexican countryside because Mexican farmers cannot compete with subsidized grain coming from the United States. So you want to know why, you know, people are moving north? It's because of these free trade agreements like NAFTA. There's one being discussed right now in terms of the Pacific as well. These are designed by corporations, help enabled by governments, which are in collusion with them, to enhance global corporate profits. This is the whole globalization, the Washington consensus, the neoliberal economic agenda, which has really dominated economic discourse since the Reagan period, since the early 1980s. So we need to have, again, an independent media that would cut through the propaganda and tell people what these so-called agreements are really about. And I think, you know, it's critical that, yes, democracy is being weakened. I don't think there's any question about that. I alluded to that in my talk in terms of what's happening with people being held without bail, habeas corpus being waived, the rendition, torture, surveillance, spying, snooping, all of these things that are going on during the so-called war on terror, which has now entered its next phase. By the way, this war on terror will never end. It is a permanent war which will be used to justify ongoing military weapons, ongoing expansion of the Pentagon budget, and ongoing U.S. military intervention around the world, which sparks retaliation, which sparks more intervention. You see the closed circle that they've created, and the propaganda system buttresses all this with, you know, stories about 9/11 and the victims who suffered, and they did suffer. It's a terrible thing. But, you know, there's huge numbers of people that are under the boot of the U.S. military right now around the world, and they don't like it. It's not surprising. And that's why you have the pushback. That's why you have the growth of fanatical organizations, some of which were enabled by U.S. government policy. I don't think anyone doubts that the United States and the Reagan administration, in particular in the 1980s, funded and trained and armed the most fanatical Islamic fighters from around the world that were recruited at our expense, by the way. It was all paid for by taxpayer money, to come to Pakistan, to go into Afghanistan. Then there's blowback. Who do those people become? They became the Taliban. They became Al-Qaeda. They became also these other, even the Khorasan group, which we are told is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. How come there have been this proliferation of all of these groups around the world, terrorist organizations? What's the root cause of that? Can we make any connections with U.S. foreign policy? That's the taboo. You cannot. You cannot talk about U.S. foreign policy in any realistic terms and the consequences of that policy, because then we'd have to be talking about imperialism, which is totally off, you know, beyond the pale in terms of, you know, describing U.S. Foreign policy. It is an imperial foreign policy. It's based on resource extraction. It's based on domination of other countries and plundering, looting, as in that quote that Professor Black brought to my attention. Thank you. Sorry for the long answer. How are we doing on time?
We're okay. My question is to you, who I've dreamed asking people in the powerful right who have the money, who want to make more money. I know they want to make more money. They want to build their power. What do they want for their grandchildren? How do they see their grandchildren? Mr. Koch, Mr. whoever, what do they view is going to keep their grandchildren, their progeny, and nurture them?
That's a question that often actually comes up, you know. Well, what about these guys that are the captains of industry, you know, that are responsible for the eco crisis, the accelerating eco crisis? Well, I asked this very question of Chomsky, as a matter of fact. So let me just read you his answer because it's far more eloquent than anything I can say. With capitalism, it's an institutional imperative. By imperative, I don't mean it's a law of nature. You can change it. But given the way institutions now function, their core goal is to maximize short-term profit and power. That is the critical element for the decision makers in the economy and the society, and therefore in the political system. And that leads almost directly to destruction of the environment. In fact, we can see it right in front of us. The threat is quite serious. The major agencies that monitor global emissions have released report after report documenting their findings. I'm sure if you talk to David Koch or Charles Koch or any of these, gazillionaires. I love my grandchildren. I think about them all the time. They're, you know, in fact, one is named after me. But the institutional imperative of capitalism compels them, puts them in a straitjacket where they have to maximize profit today. Otherwise, they're out. The shareholders will vote them out. There was a New Yorker cartoon that came out a couple of years ago. Michael Parenti, who's been on alternative radio multiple times, brought to my attention. A CEO of a big corporation was talking to his shareholders. This is in some hotel ballroom in New York. And they were all on their feet, you know, yelling at the CEO, hey, where are the dividends? Where are the profits? Come on, you know, we're giving you a private jet. You wanted a yacht. We gave you that. You wanted an apartment in New York and Paris. We gave you those things. You know, you got all these perks and benefits and retirement funds and golden parachutes and all that. You know, where are our profits? Where are our dividends? And he, you know, puts his hands like up like this and says, calm down. And he tells them, while the long-term prospects for the planet are grim indeed, in the short term, we're going to make a financial killing. Everyone jumps up and gives him a standing ovation. I mean, there you had the acknowledgement. I mean, they're not stupid people. They read these reports also. But the institution, let me finish. The institution of capitalism prevents any kind of flexibility in terms of dealing with the long-term crisis. Otherwise, they're out. Yes. Well, I think the rich think they'll find some way out. They'll go to the moon, build a condo there, cover it up, and buy their own air, buy their own water. I mean, there are already trends in that direction. You know, they'll be able to buy themselves out, they believe, and protect themselves. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so alternative radio has been on for many years, and you've produced quite a number of outstanding programs. I'm curious, is there one that stands out, like as a favorite, or maybe a couple, if that's too hard to narrow it down to one?
Well, I think my recent work with Richard Wolff, and that's a plug for a new Wolff book and CD that I have today. Chris Hedges is extraordinary. I did a program with him, maybe you heard it, called Captain Ahab and U.S. Empire, where he compares Moby Dick and Melville's novel to what's going on today in terms of the obsession with profits, that Ahab has this fanatical drive to kill Moby Dick, you know, and what does Moby Dick, who happens to be white, the white whale, is really the environment, is really nature, is really purity and innocence. But Ahab wants his pound of flesh. He wants revenge for the damage that Moby Dick did to him. You know, he has an artificial leg. So I think it's a great piece of work. Some programs with Howard Zinn and Chomsky also have been very, very popular. It's hard to say over, you know, I've done thousands of programs now over the years, which one really stands out, but the Richard Wolff things on the economy, I think, are very valuable because he speaks English, which is not something to snicker at. Most academics, most economists in particular, speak with data, speak with graphs, speak with charts, and you need like a simultaneous translation in English to understand what's going on. So Wolf is down, you know, he's down home, he's very straightforward, and he's very clear, and so he's reaching a lot of people.
There are some wonderful programs out there working on a number of very important issues. I think of Move to Amend. I think of some of the peace programs, the social justice programs, and so forth. Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein has written some wonderful articles. Mm-hmm. On
her new book just came out, This Changes Everything.
Exactly.
Two copies back there.
Relating how we need to tie together some of the climate disturbance, environmental issues along with economic issues. We need to be tying together the various issue problems and seeing how they are connected. Now, you have been moving around the country a good deal. So my question is, in your context, in your relationship with many folks and groups, do you see some real hope here that there can be a tie-in with these many wonderful groups in that we can set up a movement of movements? This is a term that Chris Hedges has used.
Yeah.
And that it then can be effective to make real changes.
Yes, we already see glimmers of that, and I see it all over the country. I mean, I have the opportunity to move around, to speak to different audiences, not just Unitarians, as I've done in Seattle and Anaheim recently, and will soon do in Boulder on October 19th, I think, but also other groups like Elks Clubs and Rotarian, Rotary Clubs and veterans groups, unlikely groups, you think, that are concerned about the climate in particular. They are concerned about the economic crisis, which is not over, incidentally, even though Obama announced 5 years ago that we are now in the recovery. The fact is that the economy is absolutely stagnant, and there's still a great many people that are out of work or doing part-time work when they'd rather have full-time jobs. So that, you know, there is a lot of concern around the country. The thing is to find the catalyst that's going to make a great movement. As we saw in the 60s, for those of you old enough to remember the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement, to reach a critical mass. You know, what is it going to take? Now, that New York thing that happened a couple of weeks ago was very exciting. Close to 400,000 people came out. And as was mentioned on Tell Somebody, there was no coverage of it on the Sunday morning newscast. But nevertheless, those kinds of things are happening, and we need to make them grow. We need to expand. And I think part of the way we can do that is the language that we use also. You know, is it pedantic? Is it I told you so? Is it vituperative? Is it poisonous and toxic? Or is it more embracing? This is what's going on. You know, I want you. If you ask any parent, okay, this is liberal, conservative, left, right, middle, in between. Do you want your kid to grow up in a healthy environment? That's a no-brainer. You know, do you want your kids to eat nutritious food? You know, that will, you know, make them grow into healthy adults. Do you want them to drink clean water? This is not a left issue. This is a basic common sense issue. And I guarantee you that every single parent or person will answer in the affirmative, be they of extreme, whatever is called right wing, or extreme left wing. So there's common ground there, where we can find the openings. That's what Gramsci said, the great Italian socialist communist, to finding apertures, finding openings in the culture, and filling those openings with bursts of energy. and to make those openings bigger. So it is, it's not a monolithic system. There are cracks in the system. I found this little niche where I created alternative radio. There's other ways to do things and to you know, grow the opposition, to grow this movement into something that will be radical and transformative. And ultimately, it has to be collective action. It can't be one-offs. The climate change crisis cannot be solved by Canada. In fact, Canada is one of the worst offenders of global warming, with tar sands and mining and other, you know, catastrophic environmental things that it's doing. It cannot be done by individual countries or even small groups of countries. It has to be global. It has to be through the UN. It has to be through a collective effort. That's how it's going to be addressed and ultimately reversed. Yes.
Welcome and thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
I recently heard a TV personality say, yeah, it makes me happy to help others. Okay. Now, I guess the mentality that I see in the corporations and government and people is that it makes me happy to help myself at the expense of others. How can we realize when we have enough and it's time to start to help others, with other being like this earth? You know, instead of helping ourselves at the expense of the earth, how can we get to the realization that we have enough and now it's time to start to help others?
It's a change in consciousness. And, you know, I think Unitarians help lead the way in terms of embracing other peoples, the less fortunate in society. You know, I don't have to tell you, Missouri is in the news not just because of the Royals, but because of Ferguson. So, you know, we have a lot of things, a lot of issues to address right here, you know, in our communities that, you know, require attention. But, you know, it seems kind of banal to say a shift in consciousness, but we have to become people-oriented. The economic system is profits-oriented. It's all about generating more and more money, more and more income. And so that's going to require a tremendous shift. We see some really positive things. I don't know, you must have community farmers markets here and community-supported agriculture where people take out subscriptions and support independent organic farmers. There's a movement that has been growing quite dramatically over the years in very positive ways. So if we can do it in those areas, in food co-ops, there's been an explosion of co-ops around the country. Did you know Ace Hardware is a co-op? There's all kinds of groups now that have gone co-op. There's Mondragon in Spain that Richard Wolff talks about, very successful co-op. So there are possibilities. The thing is not to give up hope. We have to keep hope alive. I know that's terribly, that's a campaign cliche, but we do. We cannot succumb to despair or depression. We don't have the time for that because the crisis is so urgent. As Eduardo Galeano said when he was asked this question, the great writer from Uruguay, he said, I'll save despair for better times. Right now, it's a luxury to indulge in depression and despair. Let's save it for better times.
Okay, I've had this saying for a while that, you know, the corporations are going to screw us for something. Why don't we just get them to screw us for things we want and not things we don't? But now that they've got a hold of the spigot to the money in D.C., who are the people that have the program plan to cut that spigot off?
Well, I think the Move to Amend movement is a concrete effort to get money out of politics, but that's going to take some time. I think we have to think about, you know, people like Bernie Sanders and the senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, and others who are, you know, talking about these particular issues. We've got to get money out of politics. It's having a hugely corrupting effect. We need public financing of elections. And we need candidates, for Christ's sake, not the cyanide and you know, the other poisons that are served up every 2 years and 4 years. We need a vital political system. But the money is a huge part of the reason that we don't have a vital political system that is responsive to citizens' needs and the Earth's needs. Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I believe it was Naomi Klein who said that the right-wing capitalist knew that if they acknowledged climate change, that they would have to totally redo their plan of action, and they have to totally change how they're doing business. So it made me think that that what we need to do is to end capitalism as we know it. And I wonder if you could just comment.
Well, that's been the theme of my talk. This economic system is incapable of addressing the climate crisis. They're only going to offer you placebos. They're only going to offer you, you know, as I said, recycling cardboard or, you know, driving a fuel-efficient car. They're not going to talk about fundamentally altering the way we do business in this country. And it's absolutely essential. Naomi Klein is absolutely right about that. Chomsky talks about it. Richard Wolff talks about it. Everyone who's thinking thoughtfully about these issues understands that the problem is with a system that is based on constant resource extraction and constant generating of profits. That has to change.
Can I make you first in Conover?
Yeah, fine.
Oh, great, great. You get to be first in Conover. Next week's forum. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to David Barsamian talk about media, capitalism, and the environment here on the All Souls Forum today. This program was recorded on Sunday, October the 12th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. The theme song